This is March 14th, Monday morning, and 2005. And I'm here with Dr. Harkness, and we're going to talk more about his career.
I finished up in our last session talking about the history of the development of the HMO, which was instrumental in providing or preserving the patient base for teaching purposes. And one of the persons that I think, whom I think we owe a great deal to is Gordon Durzon, who was superintendent of the hospital at that time. He had the foresight to realize that we must start an HMO since we were going to lose all of our patients if we didn't offer an HMO. And that was due, as I said before, to the mandate by the state that state employees had to be offered this option. But Gordon also had an interest in developing a network of clinics outside of the hospital, and he was the person who was the leading force in talking the chairs of the clinical departments into putting a great deal of effort into developing these clinics. And of course they have proved to be very important in terms of sites at which we could see the HMO patients. But I think that all of the clinical chairs really owe a great deal to the work that Gordon led us towards, and certainly at the same time he was preserving the finances and the health of the University Hospital, which I think we all appreciate. It over the time that I've been in academic medicine, there's been quite a change in the faculty numbers and their credentials. When I first started out as an assistant professor, departments were extremely small and everybody was in the so-called tenure track. Then when Medicare and Medicaid came along and there was an opportunity to see large numbers of patients and be paid to see these patients, faculty numbers increased, but many of these faculty members were primarily hired to see the patients and do the clinical teaching of the students and the residents. With time here at the University of Wisconsin, we developed then the tenure track and then the what was called the Center for Health Science, or the CHS track. But gradually over time, the requirements for promotion became more and more stringent in both of these tracks. And as our clinical load increased and we had all of these patients registered in our HMO, it became obvious to me that many of the people that we were hiring in the CHS track were not going to have the time or perhaps even the talent to develop a resume that would merit promotion to the associate professor and then finally to the full professor level. So I made a proposition to the dean of the medical school that we be allowed to hire full-time clinical faculty members. And so as I recall, there was considerable discussion about whether we should open this door, but I was given that approval, and subsequently it turned out that that was probably a pretty good move on the part of the medical school, because in the more recent merger with Physicians Plus, when literally hundreds of physicians joined the faculty at one time, almost all of these physicians joined as full-time, that is paid, clinical professor track rather than CHS. So, as I say, things have become more complex as the that is, expectations for faculty have become varied and more complex over the years, just as the academic medical centers have become more complex. I'd like to turn now to one of the real joys that I had and one of my missions that I had as a chairman of the Department of Medicine. I highly valued my relationship to the assistant professors that I was fortunate enough to recruit in both the CHS track and in the tenure track. And especially for the persons that were in the tenure track, I made certain that we put together a package of 3-year support with technician, equipment, and supplies so that they could have an opportunity to develop a track record in advance to writing their first successful NIH grant. I mentioned earlier in the first interview that it was easy to put, quite easy here at Wisconsin to put these packages together because of research funds that came from the graduate school, from foundations such as the Rennebaum Foundation, and from the research funds within the department that represented a portion of the clinical income for the department. My relationship to the junior faculty was such that I met with each one for approximately an hour each spring to talk to them about how their research was going, how their teaching was going, reviewed their teaching evaluations and publications, and I was particularly interested in knowing whether they had sufficient time, protected time, to for their academic activities, and when I felt that they didn't, and they made a case for needing more time, I would then make that case to their section heads. I met also with the assistant professors in the CHS track as well and had similar discussions. Research funding was not as high a priority, of course, with the CHS track.
The CHS being?
CHS is, that is the, what represented the more clinical and teaching faculty track. It's Center for Health Science is what the CHS actually stands for. Okay. So that's as opposed to the tenure track. So, and now, as I said, we have tenure track, we have CHS track, and then we have the straight clinical track. I also enjoyed my relationship with the medical students. During all the years that I was chair and subsequent to being chair, and I still, after retirement, teach in the sophomore course, a full load in the hematology course, and enjoy that very much. But also, I wrote all of the students. When I was chair, I wrote all of the students in the class and at the end of their sophomore year and invited them to come in, especially if they were interested in internal medicine, invited them to come in and have an interview and talk about elective courses that they might choose to take. And also at the same time, for those students not interested in medicine, I pointed out that I'd be happy to meet with them, but if they didn't care to do that, then I at least suggested some rather key courses that I thought that they should get experience in if they were going into other subspecialties. I enjoyed this interaction with the students, and also I did myself take the time to write all of the letters of recommendation for their internship applications, and now most departments have designated someone else to do that chore, but I took that very seriously, and I think that the students appreciated the time that I spent with them. One of the other activities that I had as chair had nothing to do with my being chair, but I think it had quite a lot to do with my understanding of the campus and campus politics altogether, was service on the university committee. I served on the university committee for 3 years at, oh, I think it probably was about from 1989 to, do we have it on the resume there?
You could probably find it fast.
I served on the university committee from 1988 to 1991, during which time the Chancellor, Donna Shalala, was recruited. So I had the opportunity through the university committee to get to know her and appreciated that contact. The university committee is the executive committee of the Faculty Senate, and plays a fairly important role in faculty governance, which is very strong on the Wisconsin campus. And during the 3 years I was on there, I had the opportunity to become pretty well informed about faculty governance, and also to have an input of helping educate the senior faculty and the chairs in the medical school about things pertaining to faculty governance in general on campus. I think it worked both ways, that I was able to bring things back from the university committee to educate the dean and fellow chairs, but also that I was able to give the university committee and Donna some appreciation about unique problems of the medical school faculty. So I enjoyed that particular activity very much. After I finished that, I served for 2 years in what is kind of the emeritus status, that's called the University Profs, Inc., as chairman of that body, which does lobbying with the state legislature regarding faculty salaries.
We're going to run out of tape here soon. Dr. Harkness?
All right. In about 1992, and maybe late 91, some discontent arose amongst the faculty members in the section of cardiology, and I began negotiating with them to try to resolve their issues. Some of those issues had to do with leadership of that section, and some of those issues had to do with a desire on the part of some of the faculty in cardiology to break off from the Department of Medicine and form their own department. This was a movement that got started nationally about that same time, but I don't believe at that point or subsequently that any department of cardiology has been formed. I may be misinformed on that. But at any rate, I decided at that time that I would, with the help of the dean, name an outside advisory committee to come in and look at the situation in cardiology and look at whether the department was being fair to them and whether they were being realistic in their expectations. And this outside committee came in for 3 days and came up with some recommendations, which I thought were very reasonable. One of the recommendations being that we needed new leadership in the section of cardiology. At about the same time that these problems were brewing, I was giving some thought to maybe stepping down as chair of the department. I had been chair for going into my 13th year, and some of the problems that crop up were problems that had been solved one or two times before and were starting to crop up again, and I was thinking that maybe it was time that we had some new leadership in the department. About that time, the medical school recruited a new dean. He was an outside person, Dean Martin. He was a clinical pathology professor from the University of California, San Francisco Medical Center. Became very highly recommended, and was a very personable individual. And shortly after he was selected, he made an announcement that he would not be able to come for a year, which was a little bit unusual. And so then the chancellor had to appoint an interim dean, and I received a call from the chancellor asking whether it would be all right with the faculty and in terms of the university committee and all. I was no longer on the university committee, but whether I felt there would be a problem if, as an interim dean, a member of the CHS faculty was appointed. This was not really within the guidelines of the university governance. Chairs and deans had been traditionally tenured faculty, but Carl Ghetto was well known by everybody in the medical school. I thought quite well liked and respected. And so I said I thought that would be fine, and so they went ahead at any rate, and he served as the interim dean then for a year until Dean Martin came. Dean Martin came in, must have been in the fall of 92, and I went over to meet with him at his request. He wanted some advice about something within the medical school, and I went over and I had a long session with him, during which time he largely held the floor and spoke, and I didn't really have the opportunity to answer any questions, nor were any specific questions really asked. He proceeded then to form an advisory committee for the medical school, and this was made up of all of the department heads and the heads of the institutes. This made up of, I think there were about 24 of us on this committee, and I well recall that we were invited to our first meeting kind of an introductory meeting, and a meeting at which we thought there was going to be an exchange of ideas. And at that meeting, it was largely a soliloquy by our new dean with very little input, some questions being asked, but before they were answered, the dean commenced to go ahead. We heard a lot about how things were done at University of California, and this entire experience with the cardiology and having some second thoughts about staying on as chair, and then with the new dean, I thought maybe it was a good idea that I go ahead and step down. So I went over and spoke with the dean, and he understood the situation, and so then I announced that I would be stepping down. I think this was in December of 92, that I would be stepping down in mid-June of 93. At that point, they went ahead and set up a search committee and started a search then for my replacement. Within a month after making the decision to step down as chair of the Department of Medicine, I learned of the potential opportunity to take a job in Japan with the National Academy of Sciences, serving as a director at the Radiation Effects Research Foundation in Hiroshima, Japan. This is, I'll talk about that organization in a moment. I went in to interview for this job, and they went ahead and offered me the job. So it was a two-year appointment with a potential for staying on if I preferred to do so. So in June, then my wife and I relocated to Hiroshima, Japan, for what turned out to be a 29-month period of my tenure as a director of that institute.
Can we pause here just
yes.
for a second?
The Radiation Effects Research Foundation is an organization that grew out of what was called the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission that was formed immediately after World War II to study the effects of the radiation of the populations in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The study started very early after the armistice, but the studies really never got highly organized for the next several years. But briefly, about 250,000 persons received at least small amount of radiation in the two cities as a result of the bombs. These bombs were detonated at about 500 meters, and so very little radioactivity, there was very little radioactive fallout, and very little radioactivity was left on the ground, so most of the radiation that the people received was instantaneous gamma radiation, a little bit like walking through the beam of an X-ray. And so that it was quite different from the radiation that has occurred in sites such as Chernobyl, where the radioactivity in the form of strontium and iodine got into the food chain and then got ingested with the subsequent results of that. But the about 250,000 persons were exposed. About 120,000 of those people were recruited into a clinical study to see what illnesses they were going to develop over the course of their lifetime, and with a special emphasis on malignancies and on autopsy findings. Tumor registries were set up around Japan so that there was very good follow-up of the people that were placed into these studies. These studies then over the years, as persons have developed disease, they had an equal population of people who were not exposed and just lived a little bit farther out from the radiation. And so there were control people who were that received no radiation versus those who received incremental increases in the amount of radiation. Radiation doses have been established for each individual in the study on four different occasions. They've been revised, most recently here within the last two or three years. But in general, the studies have been carried out by Japanese investigators along with American investigators, usually the Americans coming over for periods of 2 to 4 years. Many of the Japanese investigators have been permanently associated with the Institute. In 1975, the U.S. government was having trouble funding the total budget for the ABCC, Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission, at these two laboratories. And so the Binational Foundation, Radiation Effects Research Foundation, was developed with equal funding coming from the Japanese government and the U.S. government. Since that time, the institute has been run by anywhere from 4 to 6 directors, one as a chairman, one as chief of research. Traditionally, the chairman has been a Japanese investigator, and the chief of research has been from the United States. I was actually the fourth faculty member from the University of Wisconsin to go over to serve in the role of chief of research. The first person to go was Professor Roswell Boutwell, who was a or is a an oncologist, a research cancer biologist, and he spent 2 years there. The next person was Kelly Clifton, who is a radiation biologist in the Cancer Center here at the medical school. He was there for 2 years. And then Seymour Abramson from the zoology department, and who had done a lot of work on radiation effects on genetics and mutations, went over, and Seymour actually has been there on 3 or 4 occasions, been there twice for 2 years, and then a couple stints of 6 months when they needed somebody to fill in. The work at the foundation has been of great interest to the national bodies, the IAEC, which is the body that looks at the amount of radiation that persons in the medical field or in other fields associated with radiation can safely have exposure to. And the doses of the people in the studies in Japan were quite low, and this is very valuable because this is where the radiation, the interest in the national, international groups is, because people get just very small doses of radiation when they're running X-ray machines and things like that. The reason the patients in the study had low doses is rather tragic. If they were too close to the epicenter where the bomb blast took place, they died from the blast injury or died from burns. And so it was people that were farther out who where the radiation had dispersed and it was smaller and smaller bits of radiation. Those were the persons who were survivors. And survivors were the definition of was a survivor was if they lived beyond January 1st of 1946, that is, the bombs were detonated in early August, and so the, by that time it was decided that the persons who were going to die from blast or burn injuries would have died, and so that the rest of the people were termed as survivors, and those are the persons who then have been studied subsequently. I won't say too much about what the findings have been, except to say that there were a lot of hematologic malignancies early on, excess hematologic malignancies, and most of the findings, the clinical findings, pertain to the excess cancers of the different types that have occurred in this population. It has not been epidemic. We can call it tragic, certainly, but it's not been epidemic. They're probably, it's estimated that in the studies of the people that were being followed, there were 120,000 people. If there were 240,000 to 250,000 people who received these exposures, then there's been about 500 excess deaths due to cancer over the last 60 years in this population. So we would double that, and so of the exposed people, it would be probably around 1,000 excess deaths due to cancer. The other, there were other medical complications, but they were quite minor, such as some increase in the number of cataracts and some increase increases in other illnesses, but by and large, the data that are most that have come out have been mostly pertaining to the excess malignancies. My wife and I thoroughly enjoyed our time in Hiroshima. I think maybe I had mentioned earlier in the interview that I had originally gone to high school in Japan, and so it was fun for me to go back some 50 years later almost to see the changes that had taken place in Japan. It was also a little embarrassing to find that some of the words that when I took Japanese in high school were no longer, they were considered out-of-date words when I tried to use them 50 years later when we were there. My wife is Nisei, born in this country, but she had good language skills in Japanese, and so she had a marvelous time living in Hiroshima for those 2 years. After coming back to the States in 95, I didn't have any real assignments within the Department of Medicine. I certainly wasn't going to be able to develop a research program after letting that aspect of my career lie dormant for 20 years. I was not and never was an accomplished clinician. I was rather specialized in the types of patients that I had taken care of over my career. Most of them had been hereditary red cell patients with hereditary red cell problems and acquired hemolytic anemias as well as inherited. And so I was looking for something to do outside of the department, and at that time the head of the Continuing Medical Education Office, Tom Meyer, was about ready to step down, and so I was asked to take over that job. I did this for about 2 to 3 years, and I appreciated having the opportunity to do something that was perhaps meaningful, but it wasn't my bag. Continuing medical education is a very important area, but I had no particular expertise in there, in that area, and didn't find it particularly fulfilling. So as I may have explained earlier in the interview, when I first was hired, I had made a point that when people reached a certain age that they should go ahead and voluntarily retire and make room for more recently trained junior faculty to take their offices and take their positions. So at 65, I went ahead and retired. I continued to do the CME office for a year or two, but then I think it must have been 1998 that I finally retired totally from the faculty. Retired happily, enjoyed very much my years on the faculty, both as chair and subsequent to that, and have always appreciated that opportunity that I had to end my career with that. I think I'll stop there.
All right.
Since retiring, I have continued to, I continue to do resident teaching several times a month, where I talked on hematologic subjects, and continue to teach in the sophomore hematology class. A few years after I retired, I developed myasthenia gravis and had difficulty with my speech and slurring, so I stopped the teaching of the residents, but on medication I have been able to continue the teaching and of the medical students. I've done a number of other things. I was on the board of the Institute on Aging for a number of years. I served on the board of the Friends of the Waisman Center for 4 years, including 1 year as president of that organization, and enjoyed both of those activities very much. I have been a volunteer driver for the Badger Blood Bank for a number of years, and both out-of-town and in-town errands, and I've enjoyed doing that as well. I've also continued to be quite active in various functions with my my church. Most recently, I've been asked to participate as a mentor in a new program that is being developed. At the beginning of this year, the classes were divided. Each class was divided into five houses. The student coming in as a freshman would be assigned to one house, and they would remain in that house for the entire 4 years of medical school, with the hope that there would be vertical feedback of information from senior to freshman and senior to sophomore and juniors through the functioning of these houses. And physical facilities were included in the new teaching center by the hospital, and so that this is hoped to be a successful venture. A number of medical schools have divided their classes in this way. Mentors have been assigned, that is, one mentor to each house, and that the function of that mentor is still being somewhat delineated, or the functions, but primarily it's going to be for career counseling for the students, to make arrangements for the students to hear in the house, individually or as groups, to hear from persons in different subspecialties and get some career counseling as to what the opportunities are. At the same time, the medical school is developing a funded program to develop a website with curriculum that is available from the AAMC, the American Association of Medical Colleges offices, on career counseling, and so that there'll be lots of materials available and resources available to work with this. So it's been estimated that this job as a mentor, which we will be doing, the five of us probably would take 6 to 8 hours a week, and we probably signed up for a commitment of 2 to 3 years at least. And so these are the things that I've been doing since stepping down, besides playing a lot of tennis, 3 to 5 times a week. And I do that without the pain that I had for 30 years while I played with sore knees, but I've had both knees replaced now, so that it's really made a difference in my game. And I'm thoroughly enjoying retirement.
That's wonderful. Thank you very much, Dr. Harkness. We appreciate your time.